got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always. Kevin, how you doing?
Wonderfully scorching hot here in Florida today as we flirt with 100 degrees. It's horrible outside.
Yeah, I'd say I feel sorry for you, but I don't because it's also 100 degrees here too. So I think we're both equally miserable.
And in Siberia, I hear.
Wait, what?
It was the hottest temperature ever recorded in the above the it was in Siberia, 100.4, the hottest it's ever been recorded above the Arctic Circle.
Dang, man. It's a crazy world we're living in. Got all this crazy genetic engineering technology coming down and all these temperatures, and I don't know what's going on, man.
Well, science can save us, maybe, probably not.
You can tell we're an optimistic pair here on the Science Facts and Fallacies show.
Well, I would be more optimistic, but I don't think it'll change anything.
Yeah, well, on that positive note, let's dive into three very exciting stories. So first up, the chemical company Bayer has just settled about 95,000 lawsuits alleging that its Roundup weed killer causes cancer. So we're going to get into the details of the case and what this means for the biotech crop debate, because this is a major development. And then mosquito spit could yield vaccines for dozens of deadly diseases. So we're going to talk about that. CRISPR has been used to develop a quote, functional cure for two genetic disorders that currently require lifelong treatment. So that's also a big development. And Kevin, I want to get into the biggest story, though, that I think we need to talk about, which is these Bayer lawsuits. So give people a quick rundown of what's going on.
Wow, where to start? So this has been going on for a number of years. For ages, the anti-biotech folks have, they've been targeting the biotech seeds and always saying, well, they cause cancer, they cause all these problems. None of the health claims ever held up. So probably about 5 years ago, they really started to switch their focus from the seeds and the crops to the herbicide that's used on a majority of them. So switching to glyphosate, which is a chemical, it's an herbicide, it works extremely well, and it's been touted as being extremely safe, extremely low toxicity, on the order of acute toxicity of, I think, is less than coffee, you know, in terms of its acute toxicity. So the problem with this for activists was, where do we go from here? But since it is an herbicide and it has that CIDE suffix, you know, it kills things, it still is a good way to scare the public. And if you could convince the public that it was the herbicide that was the problem, now you could start to make inroads into possibly eliminating that. And then eventually, if you can't have the herbicide, what good are the seeds? So they started this kind of strategy, really rolled it out back, you know, probably 2010 or so, maybe even a little earlier, but really with the Seralini paper in 2012, where he said Roundup herbicide, which is the brand name for glyphosate-based herbicides, causes cancer in rats, causes tumors in rats. And ever since then, it really started to open a downspout of activity around the notion that this would possibly be carcinogenic.
So this has now culminated in these thousands of lawsuits. And so far, three have gone to trial, and the juries have all found against Bayer for hundreds of millions, and then in one case, billions of dollars. And those damages have been reduced, and all of the cases are on appeal right now. So we don't know what's going to happen with those. But basically, it seems that the American court system allows this to continue, because if you can present what seems like a compelling case to 12 people with no scientific background, then you can just keep piling on these lawsuits. And effectively, you can bankrupt a company if you want to. And so from what the reading I've done, Bayer just did some math and they're like, well, what's it going to cost us potentially to keep fighting this in court versus settling the majority of these cases? And they came down and said, okay, well, we're just going to have to settle this. So what's your take on the significance of a decision like that, Kevin?
Well, there's significance on multiple levels. The main thing for me is that there's no concrete evidence anywhere that shows a link between glyphosate and cancer. Any associations have been extremely tenuous, and statistically, you know, you have to really pull them out of the mud in order to see them. There's no strong evidence that they cause cancer. Yet the fact that you can get attorneys to essentially convince a population that it does. Everybody's seen the commercials. Everybody's seen the stuff online. Never ends. And essentially, they were able to find 12 jurors that they could twist into believing that it does cause cancer. And when you're 12 jurors in a box, a big bad company on one side, and you know this poor guy who's suffering from cancer, it's easy to get that vote. So here they were looking at a docket of 95 to 125,000 plaintiffs who were all signing up for their piece of the pie. And do you really want to go through 125,000 court cases? So when you do the math on this, which is what, you know, what the lawyers wanted in the first place, you know, the tort lawyers wanted was they want a big payout. They want a big settlement. They want billions of dollars. That's what they're in this for. It's not about justice. It's not about helping people with cancer. If anything, it uses the people with cancer to get those billions of dollars. And so this was just a way to get a company to settle and tighten the screws so hard that the only thing they could do would be settle it for billions of dollars. And they admitted no guilt. They said our products are perfectly fine. So what this basically means is that Bayer paid some attorneys $10 billion to leave them alone.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I read in a Reuters story today that the average plaintiff, depending on how severe their case of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is, which is the only cancer that this is relevant to, the average plaintiff gets between $5,000 and I think $100,000, somewhere in that range. So for all of the money going into this big settlement, most people are just getting just a fraction of the money. So just to put that in perspective for you, you know, this is not going to compensate people who have been wrong. This is going to compensate lawyers who were able to construct an effective narrative. But you made an interesting point, Kevin, that Bayer didn't admit fault in the settlement and they required that language to be in it. But this sort of sets up a weird precedent because on the one hand, they settled for a ton of money. I think it's the biggest, I forget if it's a defective product suit or whatever, but it's the biggest settlement of its kind in U.S. history, I'm pretty sure. But then they're still legally allowed to sell Roundup. And so if you're an attorney and you're not a part of the settlement, then this is pretty easy to spin. You know, you can say, look, they didn't admit technically, but they settled for all this money and now they're still trying to sell the product. I mean, what a heartless company, you know? So it sets it up for the next battlefront, if you will. And indeed, there are lawyers, and I think U.S. Right to Know, one of the activist groups that's been promoting the lawsuits, has said, you know, this is robbing people of their right to a jury trial, and you know, this isn't good enough. And so the battle is not over. All that to say, what are your thoughts?
Well, I kind of agree, but I also think that there's probably plenty of language in this that holds Bayer immune at this point. I mean, they had to put in language that says that they hold them harmless against further litigation based on these claims. And so it's hard to say how they could possibly extract more out of them. The sad part is, as you mentioned, you know, that it won't placate the anti-biotech groups. I mean, the seeds are still there. The product is still there. You know, they all were saying, oh, we need to boycott Bayer Monsanto. We need to, you know, drive them out of business and, you know, and destroy them with this, with, with these claims. And instead, what happens is, the other people who are getting paid are the investors who footed the bill for all of those ads that came up on your Facebook page and on TV. That's billions of dollars right there. And those folks invested that money with the idea of getting a big payout. So I know the Reuters numbers between 5,000 and 100,000. I'm betting most of the plaintiffs in the class probably are on that 5,000 end. And, you know, $5,000 to a cancer patient, terminally ill patient, I mean, I guess it's something, but I really feel bad that this went this way, because at the end, the science is the same. There is no link to cancer. I mean, no strong association, nothing that shows it definitively. And unfortunately, I think they're not going to go after Bayer much more, but I think they're going to go after the next, silicone breast implants, baby powder, glyphosate. You know, what's next? You know, cell phones. It has the same degree of evidence that it causes problems.
And that's a good transition. And I've heard, I've seen on Twitter, Gary Ruskin, who runs US Right to Know, he has made comments to the effect of, you know, they say glyphosate is the safest pesticide that's ever been available to farmers, and yet we have juries saying that it causes cancer. So what are they not telling us about these other pesticides that are on the market? And so, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I know there's been other lawsuits filed related to different classes of pesticides, but it seems that they're setting it up to say, look, if the safest one isn't safe, imagine what this other thing will do to you. You know, so they've sort of, like you were talking about at the beginning, it's sort of an end run around the regulatory process where they can just try to get more products off the market through the courts.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, there has not been a regulatory agency on this planet that has ever connected glyphosate to cancer in a meaningful way. Just a tenuous assessment by the IARC back in 2015 that started all of this buzz, or really played into this buzz. And there's a lot of corruption around that. So yeah, I agree with you. This is just setting up the next big grab and the next big takedown of a company, which doesn't affect the company. It affects their insurance and the people who back them and their stockholders and their customers. And ultimately, it just means that we end up paying more for food. And that's the big problem, is that it's just an abuse of litigation loopholes, and it really should stop.
Yeah, and the final thing before we move on to the next topic, back to the point about the settlement, Bayer worked it in there so that it's going to be an independent expert panel, according again to Reuters, that's going to decide any future litigation. And so if this panel finds that glyphosate can't cause NHL, then the lawsuits die there. But if the panel finds in the opposite direction, then it's possible that they're going to face a ton more lawsuits. So there's a lot up in the air. But, you know, this is still a major development.
Mm-hmm. And then the science will speak on this perhaps in the long run. And, you know, the sad part is that the original plaintiffs who went through the jury trials, they could lose those appeals. And, you know, it will be a very interesting thing to look at from the 2025 lens.
Yeah, well, we will see. And let's leave it there for now and talk about mosquito spit, Kevin. I never thought I'd actually say that sentence, but here we are.
Well, the hardest part is getting them to spit in the cup. No, it's mosquito spit, it might be a universal holy grail for vaccines, that kind of thing. This comes from a Reuters story by Claire Baldwin. And it really goes back to the idea that mosquitoes are probably, well, I don't know about probably, they are the deadliest creature in the world. And it's not sharks, you know, it's nothing like that, not pit bulls, it's mosquitoes. And it's because malaria kills more than 400,000 people a year. And that's, just to put it in perspective, that's the current death toll from COVID, you know. And so mosquitoes have some insane impact. And it's mostly in the developing world. And the problem is that it seems to be increasing because of climate change, because of more development in places in the developing world, where, you know, places where there were never roads and never mosquitoes. Well, now there's roads and now there's mosquitoes. And so this is something that is a byproduct of industrialization and sadly will be affecting more people. So that's really the basis of this entire article.
So I believe the research that they're doing, they're trying to take a protein from mosquito saliva and then develop a vaccine for all of these different viruses and these different pathogens that mosquitoes carry. So malaria, dengue, Zika, yellow fever, et cetera, et cetera. So how does this technology work? And I believe they called it a vector-based vaccine versus a pathogen-based approach. So what's the difference and what are they trying to achieve with this?
Well, you mentioned some of the pathogens, right? So there's two different mosquitoes. You have Anopheles mosquitoes and Aegeus mosquitoes, and they vector all of these different diseases. And you mentioned a few of them there. But what's been really interesting about mosquitoes in the last decade is that the more you look at what is in their saliva, when you start looking with genomics-based approaches, so looking at the DNA that's present, you find all these viruses that nobody's ever seen before. And viruses that have never been described as human pathogens. But it really puts in the context of COVID-19 and zoonotic transfer. You know, could one of these things be able to jump or be able to, infect the right person to start the next pandemic? And so that's why this is particularly important to think about this approach. And what the researchers have done is they've started with mosquito saliva. And so rather than injecting people with proteins to make them immune to or make them responsive to specific diseases, specific pathogens, they are going after the vector itself. And the idea is that you inject folks with the saliva and the proteins in the saliva because some of the saliva proteins are known to promote the early establishment and progress of the disease in its earliest phases. So if you can make a generic vaccine that addresses the primer of all of the diseases that mosquitoes can carry, now all of a sudden you have a tool to at least lessen the severity of a wide suite of diseases rather than individual pathogens.
So the story mentions that researchers have been aware of the significance of mosquito saliva for years and years now, but this approach to developing a vaccine is very new. So do you have any insight onto why that is? Why hasn't this been targeted, say, two decades ago?
Yeah, it's hard to say because I think that researchers are more focused in on the pathogen because ultimately that's what you have to overcome. And this idea, even though it's been discussed, and there have been numerous animal studies that have been published in the last decade where you inject, monkeys or mice with saliva, they now become less responsive. They become less responsive to the pathogen when it's introduced. And so there's a lot of good precedent for this. And so they started to do the first vaccines in human trials, just clinical trials. And right now it's just taking mosquito saliva without the pathogen. And you can see a immune response to those proteins. So you are able to mount a response against the mosquito bite when you are pre-treated with the saliva proteins. So it looks like this could work okay once we start to move it down the road towards actual trials where you're challenging with pathogens. So very interesting for the future.
Yes, very cool. And I think if we combine this with the approaches to breeding sterile insects that we've talked about, and specifically most recently we talked about the Oxitec friendly mosquito, I think is what it's called. But if you can get to a point where you can start releasing these engineered mosquitoes to crash the populations of these disease vectoring populations and then have vaccines for these or vaccines that specifically address the insects, I mean, this is a big deal. I mean, I don't know if we'll totally eradicate these diseases, but we're definitely going to put a dent in them with these two technologies combined.
Yeah, I agree. Especially when you look at, what we've learned from COVID-19, right? That it's how well you can manage to keep the spread of the disease under control. That if you can keep this thing from being passed frequently from person to person, now all of a sudden you can put a very strong stranglehold on the progression. And in the developing world, this is really the big deal. How do you stop it from getting through an entire population to limit the health effects?
Well, as with just about everything we talk about, it's just a wait and see, you know, good progress, but we're not too sure yet. So with that, let's talk about CRISPR, Kevin. So we've talked about how CRISPR is being used to treat blindness. Of course, we've talked about it in the context of agriculture, and I think with HIV as well, if I remember. But whatever the case, there's a new treatment for two very serious diseases that might be available relatively soon. So tell us about that.
I love this because when you say we always are ending with a wait and see, we're seeing with this story. We've waited and now we're seeing. This is the outcome, and I am so happy about this. So the article is called CRISPR Provides Functional Cure for Patients with Beta Thalassemia Sickle Cell Disease, Preliminary Study Shows. And this is by Michael LePage in the New Scientist of this week. And this just blows me away. So when you look at sickle cell disease, it is a disease that primarily affects those of African descent and is a tragic disease because it causes a loss of quality of life rather early in life. And people live with tremendous pain, all kinds of other problems from that travel with it, and a suite of different issues that travel with it. And sickle cell disease, as the name implies, is when the usual red blood cell, looks like a little raft, has mutations in the hemoglobin, the blood-carrying part, that change its shape. And that's what leads to the problem. And so the sickle cells don't carry the hemoglobin or don't carry the oxygen correct, and they also have other physical issues that happen in their lifetime. And so now it looks like we can turn to gene editing to solve the problem.
Okay, so fill in the gaps, but from what I understand, they take bone marrow stem cells out of the patient, and then they edit the gene that controls the production of fetal hemoglobin. And so they edit that gene, and then they take these stem cells and they put them back in the patient, and then they effectively kill the other stem cells with chemotherapy. And so then you have these functional cells back in the body. Is that the gist of it? What else can you tell people about this?
Well, you got it, but let's do this in order. So when you're a fetus, you have a specific kind of hemoglobin that's being expressed in your blood. And it shuts down 6 months after you're born. You switch to other hemoglobin, normal hemoglobin. And they've always known that some people never shut down the fetal one, that, you know, it still is functional. You still have fetal hemoglobin as an adult. And it doesn't matter, you know, I mean, you know, it doesn't do things too much differently. It's just a change in the genes that provide the hemoglobin. And so we knew that it was shut down after you were born. And so that's the trick. It's shut down. Now, if you can remove the repressor, if you can shut off the off switch, now the fetal hemoglobin is back on. And that's what they've done. They've targeted this protein, which is a repressor of fetal hemoglobin. You can mutate that. Now fetal hemoglobin is on. So how does this work and how do you get it in all your cells? Well, what they do is they take the bone marrow cells, they get some pluripotent stem cells from last week, they get stem cells, and you mutate them with using gene editing, using CRISPR, to knock out that repressor. So now fetal hemoglobin is turned back on in that cell in the test tube. Then they use chemotherapy to ablate your bone marrow. They, you know, knock out all your bone marrow, it's gone. Now you don't make new blood cells. Then they give you a transfusion of the genetically engineered fetal hemoglobin expressing blood cells, and they find their way into the bone marrow. It's really cool. They actually, you put them into your blood and they figure out where to go. That's pretty neat. They go into the bone marrow and now repopulate your body with cells making fetal hemoglobin. And now the defect in the normal hemoglobin is not relevant, and it works. And they've been treating it, people with sickle cell anemia and beta thalassemia. And I think they said there are five people now who they discuss as being essentially cured. And I mean, this is something to celebrate. I mean, this is the best thing that we can talk about these days. It's really great.
Yeah, it's very cool. It reminds me of when I learned that they were engineering bomb detecting plants. And we've talked about this before, but I remember reading about that particular application, and then that flipped a light switch for me. And I went, oh, this is super cool what they can do with this, because the way it can save people's lives, in that case, you know, not losing your limbs, and in this case, dealing with this really painful condition your entire life. I mean, it's so exciting. So my final question on this is, do you think the people that directly benefit from these applications, will they be less scared of biotechnology more generally in the future? What are your thoughts? Absolutely.
I mean, this is something that has had so much interest inside the African American community. I did the podcast on this last August. It was at number 199 of the Talking Biotech series. The company Vertex and the company CRISPR Therapeutics are the companies who are doing this. And after I did that, I was contacted by multiple people who had family members or foundations that were trying to figure out sickle cell anemia. And they're professional organizations that are helping people live with the disease and manage it. And now there's a cure. And people are really excited about this. And the companies are conservative and are taking it slow. But I can imagine 90,000 people who may live without pain. And in the era of Black Lives Matter, I know it's not in relation to, you know, justice and police and that kind of stuff, but it does say here's a therapy that will disproportionately affect a disease that disproportionately affects people of African descent. And I think it's just fantastic.
Yep. And it's just the beginning from what I understand. I mean, it's everything from like prenatal disease testing to, I mean, we're not really doing it yet because it's still controversial, but editing embryos to make them immune to diseases. I mean, there's so many groundbreaking applications that are coming, and it's going to be exciting to watch and see how the world figures out how to use this appropriately, because it's massive, the impact that it can have.
Yeah, well, this is what's nice about the blood cell treatments, is that all you're doing is correcting a defect that's resident to the bone marrow. So you can't change every single cell in someone's brain or liver or whatever, but you can change the blood. And so it's a good transitional use of the technology. You're not changing everybody's cells as if you're engineering an embryo. All you're basically doing is giving them better oil at the oil change. You know, you're not creating a different motor. And I think people are a little more amenable to that. So good on them. And I just love that we're able to see this happen.
Well, you already mentioned Talking Biotech once, but why don't you tell us about the upcoming episode instead of one from last year?
Well, we have some interesting ways in which gene editing is being used in conservation and being able to come up with sensitive tests to better measure population structures. And so little different use of technology than we normally discuss, this time focusing on ecological uses in populations rather than on individuals. So good stuff coming.
Very cool. Well, check out talkingbiotechpodcast.com and geneticliteracyproject.org and at Kevin Folta, at Cam J English on Twitter, iTunes and Spotify. I'm just going to record my voice saying that over and over so I can just play that at the end instead of having to say it every time. But thank you guys so much for joining us, and we will see you next week.